This is 1A. I'm Todd Zwillick in Washington. The World Health Organization called COVID-19 a global pandemic yesterday. President Trump addressed the nation from the Oval Office, announced more travel bans, and sent markets plummeting lower. Meanwhile, across the country, more than 1,200 K-12 schools have closed or are scheduled to close, all in an effort to try and stem community spread of coronavirus. More than 850,000 K-12 students could be affected by these closures, including students who rely on schools for meals or maybe homeless. College students also face uncertainty. Candace Pinn joins us by phone now. Candace is a kindergarten teacher at the Henry Bernard Early Childhood Center in New Rochelle, New York, just north of New York City. Now, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo has declared a one-mile radius containment zone in that community in order to try to contain the spread of the virus. Several schools and houses of worship in that community have closed. Candace, welcome to 1A.
I'm glad to be here.
And Candace, you're joining us from the teacher's lounge, I understand?
Yes, so we appreciate any noise.
That's totally fine. You're in school. Any noise that you bring to the air is completely fine. We appreciate your call. Also joining me in the studio is Corey Turner. He's senior editor for NPR's education team. Corey's going to sit in with us this hour. Hi, Corey.
Hey, Todd.
Candace, tell us a little bit about your school. How many kids go there?
So we're a school of about 600 students, ages four to eight. So it's a pre-K to two building.
And how many kids in your kindergarten class?
So a typical kindergarten class has 24 students today. 10, 11 showed up.
So that's more than half the class. Mom and dad are keeping them home.
Correct.
So the state closed three schools in New Rochelle, in your area, right? But your school, Bernard Early Childhood, remains open.
That's right. We are outside of the quote-unquote containment zone. And so the three schools that were closed are three of the largest schools, probably about 6,000 students affected. Mm-hmm. We have 11,000 in our district. So it's a high school, 3,500 students, and a middle school of around 1,800, and then the largest elementary school, which has about 1,200.
So what have authorities said about why those three schools in New Rochelle are closed and not yours?
So the first case of coronavirus was someone who attended a synagogue, and they have decided to call this containment zone the circle around of about a mile around that particular synagogue. And in that containment zone, those three schools live. So there are also businesses, supermarkets, Starbucks, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But those three schools happen to be in this containment zone. And they're saying that they want to contain the virus, but all they've done is actually sent the kids home because there are students whose parents work at other schools, siblings at other schools that are open. So
it's a confusing picture.
Yeah, it doesn't sound like a
completely cohesive strategy. What have parents been saying?
So, you know, some parents who are able have elected to keep their kids home and in what they're calling, quote-unquote, an abundant, safety, right?
The old abundance of caution. Yeah.
And then the others who aren't able, which, you know, 55% of our population receive free and reduced lunch. The others who aren't able, who have to work, whose students, frankly, are safer in a school than roaming around, they send them to school. So that's why I have less than half, but I still have people coming.
Now, we got a call from a listener. You mentioned free and reduced lunch, and this is a big issue in your community, mm-hmm. Candace. Is that right?
That's absolutely right.
All right, let's hear. I want to hear from this one caller we got from North Carolina talking about this issue, and then, Candace, we'll talk to you about the kids in your community who rely on school for meals.
Hi, this is Lucy from Greenville, North Carolina. My daughter goes to a Title I school that serves breakfast and lunch. And whenever there's a school closing, like holiday time or summertime, it's really complicated to get children food. We don't have the community resources to feed all those children, and if the schools close, there are going to be a lot of hungry kids.
Candace, that's a call from Lucy in North Carolina that says that schools are a major provider of nutrition for kids in her community. What about yours?
Yeah, so simply put, yes, we are also a major provider of nutrition for many of the students in our community. Our superintendent has partnered with some community-based organizations to provide food, and she's published a schedule of where the food can be found and how much of the food is available, breakfast bags and family boxes. And she's promising to be able to provide this for the entire time that the school is closed. And so another confusing thing is that this National Guard was sent to New Rochelle purportedly to help with the containment zone, but really they're just sent. I don't know what their role will be.
Are they helping to distribute food at some of these places?
No, it doesn't look like it. It looks like the food distribution places are New Rochelle High School, Westcop, and another location on Main Street, and families are going to get the food, according to this email. It's not clear what they'll be doing.
All right. Well, Candace, your school, Bernard Early Childhood Center in New Rochelle, just north of New York City, remains open. Candace
yep.
Penn, kindergarten teacher, joining us from the faculty lounge. Candace, thank you for joining us and giving us the update from the what's called the containment zone there. I really appreciate it.
No problem. Thank you.
Well, here's what we heard from one parent who's glad that her kid's school did decide to close. This is Jen from Mountain Lake Terrace in Washington State.
My kids go to school in Shoreline, which just closed the entire district school for the next 2 weeks at least. I'm glad that they did this, knowing that a staff member has the coronavirus. I wish that they would have tested earlier, as I feel like we could have avoided some of this, potentially. I'm glad that they're taking the steps that they are. We're trying to make up for lost time, and I hope that it resolves quickly.
Corey Turner is here, NPR Education Team Senior Editor. Corey, we got the view from what's called the containment zone in New Rochelle. What's the picture nationally with K through 12?
You know, honestly, Todd, it sounds like what's happening in New Rochelle, but in microcosm, in every community across the country, you know, there are lots of districts that do not have any documented cases of infection yet who are seriously considering shutting down, canceling schools for what the CDC recommends, 14 days. But there's this really interesting and important tension, I think, between the public health risks of staying open and potentially waiting until there is an infection in your schools and what we heard from Candace, which is the public health risk of sending vulnerable kids home to households where there might not be parents, because let's face it, there are going to be a lot of parents, especially low-wage workers, who don't have sick time, they don't have vacation time, they can't work from home. And not only will these kids be at home, but there might not be food in the refrigerator. You know, a lot of people talk about free lunch. Like, it's not just free lunch. It's free breakfast, free snacks, and a lot of kids get dinner, too.
Pamela wrote on our Facebook page, yesterday, I made the incredibly difficult decision to pull my high school-age son out of school. I'm in Michigan. We have only 2 documented cases here. My son's school was supportive of my decision, and they've announced many changes and have made many tough decisions, but they have not yet closed. Views from all around the country as schools and school districts struggle with what we're all struggling with, how to handle this new, it's not even normal, the new situation of coronavirus across the country. A lot more on K-12 and a lot more on university decisions, too. I'm Todd Zwillick. It's 1A from WAMU and NPR.
Support for NPR and the following message come from our sponsor, Target. Entrepreneur Ray Phillips reflects on the mentorship and support he's received from Target throughout his journey.
Really, to have a company like Target extend a helping hand and guide us along in the process, it makes all the difference for any striving company looking to play on a higher level.
Learn more about how Target supports diverse entrepreneurs at target.com/founders-we-love.
Do you talk about the news with your friends, your family, or perfect strangers? Get the facts you need to be up to speed on this busy news cycle so you can share what you know. On the News Roundup, find the podcast in your feed every Friday.
On a secret military recording, a sound so haunting, one scientist believed it could change the world.
My mind was racing as I listened to this, and I thought, this is the way.
Join NPR's Invisibilia for the first episode of our new season.
It's 1A. I'm Todd Zwillick. We're talking about coronavirus and schools closures all across America. 1,200 schools, K through 12, have closed or are planning to close in response to COVID-19. Corey Turner is here, senior editor for NPR's education team. Corey, grades and are just one of many concerns here if kids are going to stay home. Talk a little bit about how schools are balancing the importance of education, the importance of grades, the importance of going to class, the importance of food, which we touched on for many students, and also the public health imperative of keeping people separated for now.
Yeah, I mean, I've spent much of my time the last couple of days on the phone with superintendents all over the country. And so I like to think of this story in terms of a hierarchy of needs. And obviously, the very top are the public health concerns. First and foremost, exposure to coronavirus. Is there a documented infection or, you know, fear of some sort of exposure to someone who is infected within that school community? So that's what superintendents are looking for. We should also be clear that the decision to close schools is not just up to a school superintendent. Local public health officials are absolutely in on these decisions and are helping to make these calls. But as we said right before the break, Todd, like, there are also very real public health concerns to sending kids home. If they're going home unsupervised, we know there won't be parents home, especially if they're younger kids. If they depend on their schools for free meals, breakfast, lunch, snacks, I know a lot of schools increasingly, this might surprise listeners, a lot of schools serve dinner around 4 o'clock right after school gets out. This is really important. Food insecurity is a huge issue. And you also mentioned before the break, kids who are housing insecure, that's 1.5 million kids in this country. Imagine how disruptive canceling school for 14 days is going to be for a child for whom school is really the most stabilizing force in their lives.
So how are superintendents and other officials thinking this through? They have so many different priorities here. We've had public health experts on this show this week who have said the time to separate, the time to shut it down is before you have a virus problem in your community. It feels silly and it feels like overkill to do it because you say there's no coronavirus here, but that is the time you have to do it. And there are so many other priorities at the same time. How do they express that struggle to you?
Oh my gosh, it's such a hard call. I've spoken with several researchers lately as well who say the same thing. I mean, there's been very good research of the 1918 Spanish flu looking at individual cities in the U.S. And you can see, you know, the earlier they closed their schools, you know, they saved lives. So the research is pretty clear that closing schools is a powerful way of slowing down epidemic. But, you know, I spoke with Sonia Santelizes, who is the CEO of Baltimore Public Schools, and she said, look, for many of my kids, I know that school is the safest place they can possibly be right now. It's a difficult calculus. So one of the really interesting things I'm seeing right now behind the scenes, just about everywhere, is superintendents scrambling to figure out, all right, most importantly, for these kids who depend on free meals, how can we get food to them if school is closed? So you're seeing a lot of really creative improvisation. I've seen, I think it's in Tacoma Public Schools in Washington, they've created a sort of drive-through system where they're putting breakfast and lunch for, I think it's 2 days at a time, in bags, and creating designated pickup points where parents can just drive right up, grab the food, and head out. You can walk up if you need to, get the food, and head out. I even spoke with a superintendent of Wyoming, Jillian Balow, and she said they're thinking about doing the same thing because they have kids who live in really remote rural communities, and they have to figure out some way to get food to these kids as well.
So we had a caller before who was talking about actual class content, grades, also important, maybe not the most important thing when you're talking about health, safety, and getting fed, so we understand that. But talk a little bit about how different school districts can handle the academic part of this. I mean, some districts probably can get on Skype or an app and have the kids do it that way. I don't know if that's the case everywhere.
Yeah. So this is really complicated stuff. I think it's, I don't think there's any one answer here, but my impression, having spoken with a lot of district leaders, is that most districts, if they cancel class, they're really not going to be able to pull off any sort of massive e-learning initiative. And so many of them are basically facing the prospect of treating these days basically like snow days. And they'll either have to find time in the summer to make them up or get a waiver from their state and basically just write them off, which obviously is a really tough choice.
And we also heard from two parents who were concerned about a lack of guidance from administrators in their school districts. Listen to Addison in Florida and Teresa in Indiana. They called our inbox.
There's no communication from the schools about planning to keep the children home and having them do studies from home when the virus becomes community spread in this area. We're one of the first places to get somebody that had it and was diagnosed with it. So we know it's in the community, but the schools are only saying they have increased cleaning and the nurse going through the school checking the students.
Our superintendent has not sent out any communications in the West Lafayette Community School Corporation about anything the community is doing to prepare. The last we heard was 5 days ago that a parent was tested in our community and the test came back negative. And there's been no advice about sources to follow that are reliable or anything else from our leadership.
Corey, we do not have a national education system in this country. That's not how we like to do things. We have a mosaic system. Every community is different, so there's no one answer to this.
I like that mosaic system. Yeah. It's putting it so gently.
It's putting it in the best possible light. But some parts of the mosaic can be broken, spotty, or ineffective.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the really profound differences between, I think, our response here in the U.S. to coronavirus and responses in places like Japan or Hong Kong or China. There's no way in the U.S. to just suddenly shut down all the schools. And while I'm sympathetic to parents who say, look, my school leaders are not communicating with us. They're not explaining what the plan is. I am also a parent. This is a confusing time. But I will also say, having spoken to an awful lot of school leaders, they've never been through this before. This is complicated stuff, and they are juggling enormous considerations. And there just aren't easy answers for many of them.
That's Corey Turner of NPR. Corey, stand by, because I want to talk a little bit now about the big kids. I want to talk about colleges and universities. Tracy wrote this on our Facebook page. Our daughter goes to UC Davis and will be coming home and taking her virtual classes and finals. I have MS and a very compromised immune system. I'm very concerned about exposure. Tough choices have to be made. I want to bring in Jeffrey Young, senior editor at eSurge. That's an online publication that focuses on education and technology. Hi, Jeffrey.
Hey, thanks for good to talk with you.
Yeah, good to talk with you. So, Jeffrey, let's talk about colleges and universities. Several colleges, universities we've seen in the news are planning long-term closures. Some are currently on spring break. Some have said go on spring break and don't come home. What's it going to look like? A lot of campuses will be doing e-learning, I guess.
Yeah, and the numbers of campuses closing is changing quickly. Yesterday, when I looked at a database that's tracking this, it was 100 colleges and universities in the United States that had closed. And today, that same list is at 200 colleges. And it affects a lot of students because some of these colleges are very large state universities with tens of thousands of students each. And in most of those cases, they're canceling in-person classes, but they are saying they're going to finish out the term online. But this is an unprecedented situation to make that kind of instant switch to a format that a lot of professors have never done before.
Online classes are nothing new on a lot of campuses. You mentioned it. Lots of campuses have it. There are entire universities that are online. But if a campus is mostly lecture room based, this is a big change. What is the adjustment like?
Yeah, well, on our EdSurge podcast, we just talked yesterday to one learning center director who's really trying to help their faculty. And it sounds like some professors are using these kind of tools themselves, you know, to talk with people on research projects on, you know, Zoom or Skype. But others, there's some pretty unfamiliar tools that they're going to be suddenly asked to use. It sounds like the typical thing is going to be for professors who don't really know how to do online learning or have never done it before, to sort of turn on their webcam and do a remote class where people might be either live sitting at their own laptops wherever they are and just try to hold a seminar that way, or to record a lecture. And one learning center director I talked to said that professors, since some campuses are still open, the professor could go to an empty classroom and record it there and upload the lecture. But in many cases, I think they're doing it in their faculty offices or at home to record a lecture and then upload that to a system that the students have access to and then have other assignments and other things online.
But of course, all of this only works if the students have internet connectivity where they are.
No, that's true. And I mean, the thing about the number of campuses that have closed, we're talking about a lot of different types of students. I mean, I think sometimes people close their eyes and think of like a residential campus, but a third of students in the United States go to community colleges and, you know, access colleges that may or may not have the kind of tools at home that people take for granted in other parts of the country. And so there is a big question, and colleges are saying that they're trying to make some loaner laptops available and try to sort of provide for that. But then at the same time, some of these campuses are closing, so the resources are, you know, the students are going away from campus. So I think there's a lot of details that, since this has been done so quickly, I think there's a very big discrepancy, and some students are going to have, it's going to be harder for them than others.
Jeffrey Young with EdSurge, senior editor. Jeffrey, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about low-income students, students at college on campus who may be food insecure or housing insecure themselves as their campuses struggle with what to do with the immediate health decisions when it comes to coronavirus all across the country. Corey Turner of NPR is also here with me. I'm Todd Zwillick. It's 1A from WAMU and NPR.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Uber. Uber is committed to safety and to continuously raising the bar to help make safer journeys for everyone. For starters, all drivers are background checked before their first ride and screened on an ongoing basis. And now, Uber has introduced a brand new safety feature called Ride Check, which can detect if a trip goes unusually off course and check in to provide support. To learn more about Uber's commitment to safety, visit uber.com/safety.
Hi, I'm Anoush Zomorodi, and I am the new host of NPR's TED Radio Hour. I am so excited because we are working on a bunch of new, amazing episodes. We're exploring big ideas about reinvention, making amends, and the psychological effects of climate change. Our first show drops March 13th. Please join me.
I'm speaking with NPR education editor Corey Turner about the impact of COVID-19 on students and parents and educators across the country. And we want to add another voice to this conversation now. Professor Anthony Abraham Jack is an associate professor of education at Harvard. He's also author of the book, The Privileged Poor, How Elite Colleges Are Failing Disadvantaged Students. Professor Jack, welcome back to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Tony, your own campus, Harvard, made headlines a day or two ago, the decision to close down the campus, tell students to go on spring break and not come back. Did it all seem sudden? How did the campus handle it?
It did seem sudden. The fact of the matter is, many students were planning to stay on campus, especially after receiving an email saying a couple of days before that we're going to treat it as a staycation, like cancel your spring break plans, and then we're just going to stay here so that to prevent people from going to places where they can attract the disease. And then 2 days later, they received another email saying that campus is closing. And the fact of the matter is, we are treating it as a public health emergency, and it is, but we're not accounting for the social inequalities that worsen its impact. A lot of students with the rollout, they said, don't come back after spring break. That assumes that you actually have left campus for spring break. And we know, and as I showed in my research, that's just fundamentally not true. Many students treat campus as their home throughout the whole year because they either don't have a home to go to. And so a lot of students are grappling with all these emotions of trying to figure out, oh my God, I have to get out of a place that I thought that was my own safe place, my own face of security and consistency, in 3 or 4 days, I don't have the money to move out. I don't have a place to go. I don't have access to resources to help facilitate this process. And many students across the country are not getting guidance from their institutions about how they are supposed to exit.
Corey Turner, Professor Tony is pointing to something going on college campuses that we also mentioned going on with the younger kids across the country, which is that in many cases, for many kids, school may be the safe place.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's such an interesting parallel. It's such a parallel system. And the word you used earlier to describe our public K-12 school system, mosaic, you know, that's true of our colleges and universities as well. There's such a broad spectrum. And I've seen a huge range of responses here in the last 2 days from colleges and universities insofar as how they plan to help these most vulnerable students. Because I completely agree, this is a huge problem and schools are on the hook to help figure it out. You know, you've seen some universities in a rush to clear out campus, and they've really not done a good job of acknowledging that leaving campus is just not an option for some students. It's just not. It's not safe. On the other hand, I've seen some colleges and universities actually offer, say, emergency financial aid, not a loan, but a grant to help pay for a plane ticket. Or some schools, honestly, some schools have actually left campuses open. More broadly, I know some campuses have created a sort of a streamlined petition system where if you are a vulnerable student and going home for you is not an option, you can stay in the dorm. You just have to very quickly and easily make your case to the dean or whoever that decision maker might be. There are options, but it depends on where you are.
We got this tweet from David who said, UNC Chapel Hill is extending spring break and going online afterward, but they're keeping residence and dining halls open as of now. Hopefully there can be some measure of housing and food security for students that depend on the university for basic living needs. Professor Anthony Abraham Jack, what Corey is describing and what David is describing in his tweet points to flexibility here, flexibility in the face of decisions that a lot of campuses, let's give them some credit, probably weren't thinking about even a week ago.
Yes, there is some flexibility and there is some discretion that colleges have. And I hope that in paying attention to the kind of inequalities that we're talking about, we can actually have this conversation, because what we also must pay attention to is the other losses. Student wages, lower income students, working class students working on campus, and a lot of students, their money is already earmarked to support their families back home. Right. So if you're working on campus and you're the one that's paying half of the rent or one third of the rent, if your campus closed, and yet one third of the rent is gone, you become even more housing insecure because now you can't support. We also must make sure that students know that they continue to have their health insurance and the health insurance will cover them. But we also must make, again, concessions that many students, for their prescription and for their mental health appointments and different kind of treatments, that we are also making sure that in our messaging to students, and in our outlining of our plans, we are being explicit about what coverage they will continue to have even if campuses close. And there are concrete things that colleges can do if they are too close to provide more of a safety net that we don't have in this country. Because there are certain things that colleges can do to mobilize, from their alumni to paying for local movers, or to, as we just mentioned, emergency funds to get home, or covering the cost up front through grants, through emergency aid to get students to safe locations. And those are concrete steps that colleges can take.
Professor Jack, this is an unprecedented situation for the country. It's unprecedented for campuses and for deans and professors, and especially for students. This pandemic and the response to it, as you said, is exposing vulnerabilities that were ignored before, or even that we may not have known that we've had. This is hard and messy for everybody. It occurs to me that we might all have to step up. We might all have to step up and help out feeding, housing, helping, supporting students, college students who we know, not only family members, but kids of friends or brothers and sisters of friends, if they don't have a place to go and the campus hasn't set up a place for them, there may have to be a massive community response here.
We are in this together. I got emotional yesterday as I walked past the dorm and I saw the moving sign and students running fully dressed up to take their senior picture because they realized that they may not be able to do it for the first time in only God knows how long. And the thing is, we do need to band together. I hope that colleges reach out to alumni to ask who in the local area can help with storage, who in different cities can host events to help students find jobs, to help students navigate the transition back, to help cover some of the costs and the like. But I also want us to make sure that we're not, that things that can be institutionalized, we do, because I don't want, especially schools with multi-billion dollar endowments, students at those schools to rely on GoFundMe campaigns
right.
to support themselves, right? We need actually more institutionalized support so that when emergencies do happen and the way the world is going, that these kind of things are happening more and more, we are prepared to help students and we are building into our responses what in the end turns out to be a safety net for our most vulnerable students. And so there are things that, yes, we can do right now, but as we do them, I hope that someone in central administration is taking note of what kind of supports there are. And I really hope that alumni, that schools reach out to alumni, not just for donations, but the support of being able to help students locally and when they get back to their community, especially if we don't know when they're going to be able to come back on campus, to help them find jobs, to help them find supports. So that they can mitigate some of the gaps that are left when they leave campus and leave their secure place of food, housing, and wages.
Professor Anthony Abraham Jack of Harvard there. Corey Turner, the professor points out something that other guests on this show have pointed out in other areas of the culture and the economy this week, that this situation is exposing the vulnerabilities, the gaps, the shortcomings. We had somebody on the program earlier this week who said that this exposes the glaring gaps in employment and paid leave and gig economy and the problems with that when this pressure is applied. It seems, and Professor Jack has been clear, it's the same on campus. It's the same in K-12. This is exposing a lot of holes.
Yeah, a lot of holes in the safety net. I think we're going to see a lot of liaising. We've seen it already in the last couple of days between colleges and universities and even the federal government and the education department. You know, the idea that perhaps students who've been counting on federal work study, maybe for the rest of the year, that work study money could be converted to a grant. I mean, there are sources of income that students were depending on that are now uncertain. Absolutely. We're in uncharted territory.
There are also students around the country wondering if they'll get reimbursement for meal plans, tuition,
room and board,
housing plans, room and board. All of these questions on a lot of campuses probably unanswered for now, but I appreciate both of you joining us to answer the questions that so many of us have. Corey Turner, senior editor for NPR's education team. Corey, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me, Todd.
And Professor Anthony Abraham Jack, assistant professor at Harvard University, author of The Privileged Poor. Professor Jack, thanks to you.
Thank you.
This conversation was produced by Stacia Brown with help from Katie Klein and edited by Matthew Simonson. To learn more about them and the rest of the team, you can go to the website at the1a.org. This program comes to you from WAMU. It's part of American University in Washington. It's distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Todd Zwillick. Thank you so much for listening. This is 1A.